show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life! Life, you hear me? Give my creation life!
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Are there any questions before we proceed?
Begin countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast area.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Guy James Show. Here we are through the miracle of modern electronics, coming to you all around the country, all around the world. Thank you for tuning in this afternoon. So happy to have all of you along with us. We've got a lot to pack in a couple of hours today, and we'll get right to it. We're going to have Ray McGovern on with us coming up in just a few minutes, probably about 15 minutes past the hour. We're going to have Rick Rowley, who is an independent journalist just from Big Noise Films. He's just back from Iraq. And we're going to have Tina Richards with us in the second hour. Tina is the director of Grassroots America, and she's the one that got arrested there at Lafayette Park the other day with the horses and all that big mess that went on. Tina will be with us in the second hour as well. So we have a lot going on today, and we'll try and pack it all in. Of course, you can join us on the program as well by giving us a call at 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. Ah, well, like I said, a lot to cover today. You know, a couple of days ago, we all had the opportunity to finally hear the answer that we've been asking for through, all through Junior Bush's war. And Senator Warner, a Republican, is the one had to ask it, asked the most important question that could be asked of General Petraeus, and that was, is America safer as a result of this war? Petraeus answered, I don't know. I don't know. He doesn't know if nearly 4,000 American military deaths and over 500,000 innocent Iraqi deaths and the expenditure of how many hundreds of billions of dollars now, he doesn't know if all that's made us any safer. His answer was very clear. I don't know. And although the idiot Democratic senator from Indiana, Evan Bayh, and he is an idiot, handed him a free do-over, has there ever been a senator who's done less, been heard from less in the Senate than Evan Bayh? Empty suit. Absolute empty suit. Apologize to all the people in Indiana, but he's an empty suit. Of course, there's a lot of empty suits in Washington, D.C. today. But he handed Petraeus a free do-over so he could save face. And the first answer, I don't know, was all he needed to say. He said, I don't know, because he does know that the answer is a resounding no. And he didn't want to spoil Junior Bush's propaganda campaign, which has been so successful in swaying the modern Republican opinions. And we'll talk about Republican opinions in a little while. Bayh's second chance question did give him an opportunity to try and fix the damage, but it was too late. I think we all saw that. The commanding general of over 160,000 troops in Iraq had just said that he didn't know if his commander-in-chief's orders to invade Iraq had made America any safer or not. This is the guy in charge, don't forget. He didn't know. At that point, I lost any respect for the man I might have had. And at that point, he became just another Colin Powell to me. A man who's willing to give up his self-respect and lie for his boss. And why would somebody do that? Why is he coveting another star on his shoulder? Does he think this will make him a hero? And they do call him the hero in Iraq. What the hell has he done to make him a hero? Is he going out and dodge bullets? If he thinks he's going to get another star, he's probably wrong, because he's joined Colin Powell and, in my opinion, William Westmoreland. Men who had enormous respect, who were willing to gamble their reputations in order to please their bosses, and shame on them and shame on Petraeus. And somebody please tell me this. If not to make America safer, if not to protect our people, what possible reason is there to send 160,000 of our men and women to Iraq, to arm them, have them blow hell out of a sovereign nation, ruin the infrastructure, basically ruin the lives of most all the people in that country, and get 4,000 of themselves killed and 30,000 wounded in the process? What possible reason is there to commit such an act, if not to make the American people safer? And here we have the guy in charge of the whole thing saying he doesn't know. Tell me, General Petraeus, is it not the mindset of every one of our military personnel, every one of them, to believe wholeheartedly that they're in the service of the United States of America to protect their country and make it safer? Is it not the one and only reason any of our military personnel would take up arms against another human being and put themselves in grave danger? Risk their own lives, risk being maimed for life. Is that not the only reason? Protecting America? And so here we have the commanding general of our forces in Iraq conducting a massive propaganda campaign for months now. After all, he has said about needing more troops, needing them to stay longer. This success, that success, progress here, progress there. Here we have this man with four stars on his shoulder telling the people of the United States that this whole charade has been for absolutely nothing. I've said it. I've said it from the beginning. I've said that that all of this would come crashing down on our country in the end. Many of you have said it as well. But at least I had hoped that the commanding general of our forces in Iraq would at least himself believe that what he was doing was best for America. And then we find out that he doesn't. He doesn't know. We find out that he's been ordering our young men and women to give their lives for something that he isn't convinced of. He shows us that he's willing to continue to risk the lives of our military personnel indefinitely, but he doesn't know if it's making us any safer. What kind of a man is it that can so coldly give orders that will get his people killed for a cause that is contrary to the proper reasoning to go to war, to protect your country? What kind of man is this? Then again, what kind of man is he serving in one Junior Bush? I think we all know the answer to that question. Junior Bush is an idiot. Cold-hearted idiot at that, who's willing to sacrifice the lives of countless American men and women to make himself look better. He does it because he sees himself as the king. Petraeus is just, he's just another disgraced general now. He joins Powell, and he joins Westmoreland in the military hall of shame. Men who once had respect, but were willing to give it up to satisfy their dear leaders. What an ugly thing to happen. There was a time early on in this whole campaign that I thought maybe Petraeus might go over there and be honest with us, come back and give us an honest opinion. I thought he might. But then I thought, well, No. How many people did Bush think about to put in that position that wouldn't take it, didn't want it, or Bush didn't want to put there because they wouldn't be his lackey? And Petraeus took the job, and so I guess it was obvious to Bush and everybody else that he would be a good lackey. And that's exactly what he's become. And it is a shame. It most certainly is. And, of course, we got little Junior going to give a speech tonight. Are you going to watch that speech tonight? I am not. I'll probably have to see a synopsis of it someplace. Why am I not going to watch it? Because I value my TV set. And I'm just damn sure that if I sit there and watch it and watch this weasel get up in front of the American public and try and convince the idiots in this country who still support him to tell them that, oh, look what I'm doing. I'm having a drawdown of the troops here. When, in fact, it's no such thing. I can't watch that. I just can't do it. I thought a lot about it today. I cannot watch the guy again. He just makes me absolutely livid every time I see him on the tube. And therefore, I'm not going to watch him give a live speech anymore. First of all, he talks like a dope. How'd you like that little comment when he went to Australia the other day and said how glad he was to be in Austria? But he talks like a complete idiot. And God, I hate to say that about the President of the United States. I've had many of them that I differ profoundly with, but this is the first one we've ever had that I thought was a complete imbecile. And he is, and he's proven it over and over and over and over again. A tough-minded little weasel, but nonetheless a weasel. Oh, geez, I'm in one of those moods today. I really am. I know this thing is coming up tonight. This speech is coming up tonight. I know there's going to be a lot of people sitting at home. They're going to watch it. They're all going to be hardcore right-wing Republicans, and they're all going to go, oh, yeah, he's ending the war. He's drawing down the troops by 30,000. Isn't that good of him? Ah, yes, this man is ending the war. He's doing no such thing. He's buying time. And I'll tell you a disturbing fact that and we'll go over this a little later in the program today, but I see in this latest poll out that 31% of Republicans, now get this, you talk about some hard asses, you talk about some people that are stubborn and just plain fools, 31% of Republicans polled said they would give George Bush $200 billion more dollars to fight this war without any conditions whatsoever. 31%, roughly one third of Republicans would give this dope $200 billion more of dollars, which we don't have, to squander in Iraq on a mission that we don't know what the hell it is or when it's going to end. They would give him $200 billion with no conditions, no strings attached. One third of Republicans would do that. Oh my God. Does that not tell you everything you need to know about the Republican Party? Oh, it tells us quite enough for me, thank you. Quite enough for me. I'm going to pause a little earlier than we normally do today and get one of our guests on the phone, and we'll be right back.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. Glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon. And without further ado, as promised, I have with us someone you all know by now. I have Ray McGovern with us. Welcome to the program, Ray.
Thanks, Guy.
You've had a busy week. And although some of us didn't actually see you on camera, a couple of things I wanted to talk about today, but I was watching the hearings the other day, and I didn't actually see you, but it was unmistakably, I heard you shouting out, swear him in, when you were at the hearings. First of all, that was you, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. I was sitting in the back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They didn't like to pan the cameras back there any more than they had to. I don't know if you've seen any tapes of it or anything, but they didn't get you on camera very much. You got a couple of brief shots back there, but we all knew something was going on, and of course I knew you were there, and I knew several other people that were there, and managed Ann Wright. I know you know Ann. We were going to have Ann on the program. I think it was Tuesday. I'm not sure, but she found herself in difficulties with the law. And a lot of people did there. Do you think were they unduly harsh outside that day? I know Reverend Yearwood had a problem.
Yeah, actually had a problem is rather soft language.
Yeah,
you can go on YouTube and see how five Capitol Police officers tackled him, wrested him to the ground, almost broke his ankle. He's got severe ligament damage there, and carted him off to, they thought, jail, but they had to bring him to the hospital first. So that was really weird, and as far as I know, it was all because he had a little button on his, he's a reverend, so he has that, you know, the black shirt on, and it said, "I love Iraqis."
And I couldn't see anything provocative that he did. They talked to him for quite a while, and then all of a sudden, bam, they jumped him. I couldn't see where he did anything overt or provocative to get jumped like that.
And it was all on camera, so, you know, if there were some provocative gesture or something like that, it would have been captured. No, they clearly want to clamp down on this kind of thing. Usually the Capitol Police are fairly, responsible and aware of the fact that we're supposed to be a democracy and there is a First Amendment. But they had been told, at least to the outside people, that not to brook nothing. And, of course, Cindy Sheehan, she was hurt again, too. Her arm that was hurt before was hurt again, and she ended up in jail together with her sister and her daughter. So, yeah, it was pretty bad. Now, I was not outside. If the truth be told, and don't tell anyone this, Guy, but I infiltrated with the press. I kind of made believe I was a high-powered Washington Post reporter.
Uh-huh. No,
nobody challenged me, and so I sat there with the press for about 2 hours doing my homework and reading the paper and so forth and trying not to be noticed. So that, I think, is why I got by so easily. In other words, when I saw that they were not going to swear Petraeus in. It was one of these unusual times when there was a 10-minute hiatus between the time when the chairman, Ike Skelton, asked Petraeus to begin and the time when they get the microphone working. So it was all very awkward, but there was this sort of silence that doesn't usually obtain in those circumstances. And when I saw that, you know, he was asking him just to begin his remarks, I said, wait, you know, he must have forgotten. So And I had to yell because I was way in the back of the room. I said, swear him in. And then you could, maybe you saw it. It seemed to me you could hear a pin drop. And I went back to reading my paper, but my Washington Post newfound colleagues all took their big right index fingers out, and said, "Peter, he's
the guy." Well, the acoustics in there, nothing to write home about. It echoed loud and long in that chamber, and as you know, in the hallways there. I was in the building last week. You can hear something coming clear down the hall, and in that particular room, things resonate rather well off the walls and ceilings and everything else. I don't know why they don't put something in there to deaden the sound a little bit, but they don't.
The thing is, Guy, that was an innocent sort of exclamation on my part.
Yes.
On my part. I was remembering that, I said to countless swearing-ins of people like Westmoreland from Vietnam, even Condoleezza Rice, when she finally acquiesced in appearing before the 9/11 Commission, I can remember her taking the oath. So I said, what is this new deal where they don't administer the oath? And then I was remembering back when Senator Spector, who then was head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, when he was finally going to ask Alberto Gonzalez some questions about this illegal wiretapping, and he said, "Well, you may begin your remarks." And Senator Lee said, "Well, Senator Spector, you forgot to swear the witness in." And he said, "Oh no, we're not going to do that today."
Huh.
And Leahy was a very awkward moment. So I thought, this sounds like the same sort of thing, and it really shouldn't happen because Petraeus should have no reason to avoid being sworn in. Maybe it's the White House that wants to cut him as much slack as possible so that he can play fast and loose with the truth and not have to worry about the consequences that Scooter Libby faced when he was convicted of perjury.
I should think that if you went there with the full intent of telling the truth, you would demand to be sworn in. I would.
Petraeus should have, yeah.
Certainly.
I would have thought he'd get up and said, "Yeah, hello."
Yes.
Give me the oath, but he didn't.
Is it not true that technically speaking, he could still get cited for lying to Congress if in fact that happens? But then we look at the Gonzalez deal and we see that he lied to Congress and nothing came of it. But I think he could probably end up getting charged if he in fact lied. But that wasn't the point here.
Well, you're right though, Guy. That's absolutely right. And the whole situation spoke of the arrogance here. First of all, you have the State Department and the Defense Department. Now, Thomas Jefferson was the first Secretary of State. He came before Secretary of War, and always the State Department comes before the Defense Department. Not this time. Who chaired the meeting? Chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. And then, this is really arrogant. During that 2 minutes, Petraeus' microphone didn't work, but the ones up at the dais where the congressman was sitting and women, and you could hear, where's his statement? You got a statement? Where's his text? Oh, here it is. Oh, no, that's just a bunch of charts.
Oh, and he said a couple of off-color things going on out there as well. That then somebody reached up real quick and turned his microphone off. When Duncan Hunter was speaking to him, and when what's his name from Indiana came over and was talking to him, they said a couple things that I know they didn't want everybody to hear, and that microphone got switched off real quick. Ray, let me ask you. You're in Washington most all the time, and you attend these hearings and so forth. What do you, as a citizen, and with your groups you're involved with, and by the way, we've got somebody else later on in the program today. We've got Tina Richards with us, who felt the long arm of the law over Lafayette Park the other day. But what do you intend to accomplish when you attend the hearings and participate in these things going on there?
Well, Guy, I go back to the oath that I swore as a U.S. Army officer to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. I think this is the one opportunity that normal citizens have to watch what's going on, to see the the truth and the disingenuousness that obtains there when you have a hearing like this. And there's no substitute for it, not even the TV. You can see, as you know, you can see a lot more of what's really going on there than you can possibly by looking at the TV, plus the commentators that, you know, really don't get it. So you're in a position, after you watch this kind of spectacle, to comment freely on your own impressions based on, well, for me now it's 45 years of experience in Washington. And when I saw Petraeus there and the way he acted and the drivel that he handed out, you know, I couldn't escape the impression that I'd seen all this before in Vietnam. The fellow's name then was General William Westmoreland. He had exactly 9 rows of ribbons, just like Petraeus. You know, it was really, really a wicked flashback.
And you would certainly know about Westmoreland, wouldn't you? You had kind of some, close relationship with that, some of your colleagues in the CIA and so forth, when that whole business started back then. The name escapes me right now. Adams.
Sam Adams, yeah. Well, yeah, my own substantive responsibility, I was a Russian specialist and a Soviet analyst, and my turf, my portfolio was Southeast Asia and China. So I was responsible for gauging what the Soviets were up to and what their policy was toward China and Vietnam, Southeast Asia. So I was very much a player in that game, as was even more so a very close colleague of mine who entered the CIA at the same time I did in early 63, Sam Adams. Now, Sam and I used to have lunch, and when Sam told me in 1967 that he had discovered, by dint of effort and collecting all these materials and connecting all the dots, as they say today, when he had discovered that there were twice as many communists under arms in Vietnam than the military authorities there under Westmoreland were able to say, I was shocked. And he very quickly went out to Vietnam to have it out with them and found out that Westmoreland had put an artificial cap on the number of enemy they were allowed to count. And that cap was 208,000, and it didn't matter how many more they discovered. 208,000 was as all you're going to get, especially since we were winning the, remember, war of attrition?
Oh, yes. Quote.
So that was very, very, very much in my mind. And what happened, of course, was at the beginning of 1968, the communists attacked every village, hamlet, town, city in Vietnam, and they couldn't have done it with 208,000. There had to be at least a half a million folks, and that's not really funny because a lot of people died that didn't have to.
Well, and they were reporting at the time we were killing, oh, God knows how many every day, and those figures were inflated as well.
Yeah, and Sam, just pick up on that, guy. The president says we're killing 1,500 al-Qaeda in Iraq every month. Now, ever since the beginning of this year. Now, my arithmetic isn't all that great, but I did add up all the figures, and I subtracted those figures, the cumulative total from the number of al-Qaeda that everybody thinks is in Iraq, and I came up with a negative number, which means
sure
we killed
did.
A lot of them twice.
Yeah. Well, we've killed a lot of their leaders twice, 2 and 3 times, as you know. There's a parallel going on here, isn't there, between the Westmoreland situation and what we have right now?
Yeah, what you have is a general who, I have to say very candidly, knows better. There is no one that knows better than General Petraeus that this war is lost. That it's not really a war to begin with. It's a counterinsurgency effort, a counter-resistance effort, and it pits 160,000 troops against 25 million Iraqis. Now, the normal ratio of troops to, quote, insurgents or resistance is supposed to be 15 to 1 to kind of put down this kind of thing. You're one troop for every 15 insurgents, I should say. Now, you do the math. There's no way this can be, quote, won in a military sense. And I've been saying that since November of 2003, right. Which means almost 4 years now. It's a no-brainer. Anyone who knows anything about Vietnam, insurgency, Iraq, would know that. He knows it very well. He got a fourth star for taking the job on. The latest reports suggest he has presidential aspirations, and he certainly conducted himself this week as though he does.
And yet we've got his commander coming out and said, and Fallon, there's a story going to come out, and I think Admiral Fallon's probably going to get called before into the hearings, who's not enamored with Petraeus right now and his actions in taking that job and the way he's conducting himself. Have you heard anything about that?
I have indeed, yeah. A very close friend of mine, Gareth Porter, has an item out on Interpress Service News Agency, and it's a very, very interesting inside account of the sparks that began with their very first meeting when Fallon came out there to see Petraeus and found him to be, as he put it, the kind of a sycophant. You know, he just sort of started out by praising Fallon to the skies, and Fallon is one of these hard-bitten old Navy sailors. He says, you know, don't give me that stuff. Let's see what we can do here. They clearly are at loggerheads. Fallon is thinking of our armed forces writ large. Petraeus clearly is just looking at his little purview in Iraq. And I think one of the most telling things to come out of the testimony, Guy, was when Senator John Warner of Virginia asked Petraeus, now, this Iraq adventure, is this making America safer? And Petraeus answered, he said, well, I think we're doing the best we can in Iraq. And Warner said, no, 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 I asked you, is this making America safer? And you know what Petraeus said? He said, I don't know, actually.
I don't know.
I haven't sat down and thought about that.
Were you
this is kind of ridiculous.
Well, I nearly fell off my chair when he said that. I obviously, when he said that, he meant no, it isn't me. I mean, he couldn't sit there and tell the truth on that. Were you in the room when Evan Bayh gave him the do-over on it?
No, I didn't go back the second day. I was afraid that
your cover was gone.
Thrown into jail with the Code Pink people.
They probably got a picture of you up there close to the chairman. Now, they probably got pictures of all of you up there now.
With darts in them, probably.
Yeah, Skelton was certainly looking over everybody. He was getting a bit perturbed at the Code Pink people, and I heard him say that they had a strategy to disrupt every 5 minutes or so, and that's about the way it worked out. The hearings are going to be over here this week, or maybe they are over now today. Do you think we've accomplished anything? Do you think the light of truth has been on this, or has this been a successful propaganda campaign for the Bush administration?
Well, you know, it takes two to have a successful propaganda campaign or political offensive, those waging the campaign and those on the receiving end. The Democrats are the receivers of this, and all the press is saying that they're moving more and more to the center, that they're, you know, keeping their powder dry and will pursue a compromise such as that is much softer than what they were pulling for in the early part of the year. That really disturbs me greatly, Guy, because you know, our young people are getting killed over there, not to mention the tens of thousands of Iraqis that perish over there virtually every month. And so, yeah, it may seem like the smart political thing to take the attitude that the worse the better, you know. It'll be even worse this time next year, and then we Democrats will win really big. That is unconscionable.
Oh, it is.
And the only solution to this is the one that the framers put into our Constitution. It's called impeachment. Impeachment, I'll say one time, impeachment, don't blanch before the word. It's the necessary, it's the orderly procedure to be followed in cases where the president is guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors.
Well, you know, Ray, I was in Washington last week, and I ran over to the archives. I hadn't been over there for a long time, and I was telling my audience a day or two ago, I stood there reading that wonderful phrase, "We the People," and I had tears in my eyes because I wonder where it has gone. We know that we the people are against this. We know that we the people would put a stop to this right now, the majority of us, and yet we are ignored. And the fact that the Democrats are ignoring us is the most painful and hurtful part of it all for me.
Yeah, and that's why I, you know, whatever one says about the tactics of Code Pink, you know, it's the women of this country that are showing the courage to stand up like Cindy Sheehan does, like others have, and saying, you know, this is wrong, and don't tell me that my son died for a noble cause unless you can define what noble cause that is. And so I think what needs to happen now is we need to do what the Germans did not do in the 1930s. We need not to play it safe. We need to invade the offices of every single member of that Judiciary Committee and tell them that the Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution says the President shall be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors, and if convicted by the Senate, removed from office. Once John Conyers and the rest of the Judiciary Committee gets it into their head to initiate proceedings, they will have enough. They will have a majority. And once those proceedings start, should our president or vice president order Admiral Fallon to let the bombs fall on Iran, they might just think twice. What is this? Is Iran a threat to us? No. Why is this being done? To save the political hides of a deserter and a five times deferred person during Vietnam? I think I quit. I'll loudly quit, and I'll tell the American people what I've been instructed to do and what I refuse to do. I think there's a slight chance that if the impeachment things are initiated, that this would give the courage to people like Fallon, who know that this would mean the destruction of the rest of our armed forces, maybe a regional, even a world war, and they're just not going to do it. And that's the only hope that I see.
Well, Ray, I think a lot of people who don't frequent Washington, I get there a lot, and I know you're there a lot, and I think a lot of people don't understand. You mentioned about going to the offices of your representative and your senator. People don't understand that you do have access to do that. You can walk in and go through the metal detector and go up to your rep's office. You are allowed to, you should, and you do have access, do you not?
Sure, and that obtains in their local offices down in Florida or wherever. Sure. You know, just to find where they are, and you know, the lack of that is a telling sign that the people really don't care that much. And if there's ever a time when we should care, Guy, it's right now.
You're absolutely right. Ray McGovern, I want to thank you so much for being on the program. Always great to... We've been talking about this war with you for a long time now, since it started, basically. And I suppose, sorrowfully, we'll be talking about it for a while to come, the way it looks. But if we all take an interest like you have and many other people have there in Washington, maybe not as long as we think it might be. Ray, thanks so much for being on the program
today. You're most welcome, Guy.
Ray McGovern. I always like to talk to Ray. Ray's a good, sensible guy. He was around the CIA for, I don't know, 27, 28 years, something like that. Knows the ropes in Washington, knows a tremendous number of people in Washington, knows the mood in Washington. And I can tell you, from being there last week, there is a mood. There's something there. It's palpable. You can feel it. There's trouble in the air. I don't mean an insurrection or a revolt or anything like that, although it was, who was it, Thomas Jefferson that said we ought to have a good revolt every few years. You know, this deal that happened with Tina Richards over in Lafayette Park, I was standing in Lafayette Park the other day, a week ago. And there were signs all over the place in Lafayette Park. And we'll get to that when we talk to her a little later. But, you know, all of a sudden these cops come on horses and squad cars and everything to arrest somebody. I mean, there are demonstrations taking place in Washington every day. There were a bunch of Koreans, North Koreans, protesting out in front of the White House just off of Pennsylvania Avenue last week. Had a chance to sit on the park bench there and watch them for a while. They were protesting. Nobody said anything to them. And it's a hell of a note when Koreans can protest what's going on in North Korea, but Americans can't protest what's going on right here in our country and protest the actions of our government. It's a hell of a note. Nobody says anything to them. But yet you get people, don't get me started. I guess I have been started, and It's just a damn shame. It really is. Folks, we are losing our rights. We really are. And they need to be protected. Going to pause for a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
The Head On Radio Network. The Horn.
Join me this Friday on Foxed Up with John Fox at 10 a.m. Eastern. We'll take a trip back to the fall of 1974 when John Lennon sat behind the mic at WNEW-FM New York to promote his newly released album, Walls and Bridges. It's classic Lennon taking liberties with commercials.
Listen to this. Claycott C1. Pierre Boulez's album, The Rites of Spring, spelled R-I-G-H-T-S. Very subtle.
And he even does the weather.
All right, we're not going to bother with the weather. Just look out of the window.
Plus, you'll find out which tune Lennon and McCartney wrote for another famous band. This is Billy Shears, and hey, thanks for lending an ear.
Back with you here on the Guy James Show. Thank you for joining us today. Always a pleasure to have all of you along with us, the most informed audience in all of radio, all the folks here at the Horn, all of our show host here. We've got a great audience, and we consider them to be the best informed audience of any place you'll find in talk radio. I think that's a fact. And you've proven that to us over and over to Bob and Mark and Foxed Up and Dr. Bill and all the shows. You've proven that to us over and over and over again with your comments, your emails, your phone calls, that you are truly a very, very well-informed audience. And we appreciate that very much, and I, for one, most certainly do. I appreciate the fact that our listeners, almost all of them that I know of, keep themselves informed. I feel you're very patriotic for doing that, for taking an interest in your country. When so many people take a look from the outside and say, oh, hell, that's a mess. I'm not going to bother myself with it. I can't do anything anyway. Blah, blah, I'll leave it to somebody else. Well, we're the people they leave it to. Us and some of the crazies over on the right wing. I was looking at this poll today about wanting to bring our troops home, and I was trying to think quickly here of some analogies. Isn't this thing of bringing home the 30,000 troops they sent over for the surge, isn't that akin to the furniture, local furniture store that has something for sale for $100 and marks it up 40% and then says, you know, he's going to mark it down 20% and save you a bunch of money? Isn't that the same thing? How in the hell can you get somebody to buy that story? How is there someone dumb enough to buy that? And have you considered the fact that if we don't fight them over there, they'll follow us home? Are a bunch of them going to follow those 30,000 home now? Is that it? Have they given up on that stupid argument? Over and over and over again, you run into these idiotic remarks made by people on the right. And then I see this poll that come out, and I think, my God, what is wrong with people? How can you be, and I don't want to say this stubborn, I don't want to say this misinformed, how can you be this damn stupid? Let's say it like it is. They asked the question in this poll, do you want to give President Bush $200 billion without conditions to fight this war? 5.4% of the Democrats said so. Get the hell away from me. 10% of the independents said they'd give him $200 billion without conditions. And 31% of the Grand Old Pervert Party said that they would give him $200 billion more with no conditions. How can it be that many of our fellow citizens got their heads up you know where? They asked the other question, give President Bush $200 billion, but require him to bring all U.S. troops home safely within a year. After all that's been considered and all, I think that's a deal a lot of people would take. We'll give you the $200 billion, but required to bring them, that's not my position, but bring all the U.S. troops home safely within a year. 19.8% of the Republicans said they would favor that. 19.9% of independents said they would favor that. 16% of Democrats said they would favor that. And then the other question was to give Bush $50 billion to bring troops home safely within 6 months. Well, only 9.6% of the Republicans went for that, 19.9% of independents, and only 13.9% of Democrats, 13.8% overall. And then, the one that I think is the most likely, the one I think we ought to do, require President Bush to use existing funds to bring U.S. troops home safely within 6 months. 22.5% of the Republicans said yes, 38% of independents said yes, 56.4% of Democrats said that's what we ought to do, 40% overall. So there's your answer. Listen to the people. That is the choice the people made right there. Require President Bush to use existing funds to bring U.S. troops home safely within 6 months. That is the choice of the American people. Listen to them for a change. Huh? Wouldn't that be refreshing? Let's head on over to the phones. Hello, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, this is Juanita.
Hello, Juanita.
if we give him another batch of money and say yes another year, what, in a month or two he's going to want another batch of money?
Oh, he's...
I mean, it's just constant. What happened to the money that he got recently? It wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't. It was just right before the surge. Give me the money and we'll do the surge, and then Petraeus will lead us to the promised land.
And our troops, just our talking about our troops, is getting killed, and all it's going to take is somebody attacking, they getting hold of something, and they'll blow up a bunch of them, bunch of our people, beside the people over there. You know, how many more are supposed to die? I mean, if you stay over there another year, it's going to be at least another 1,000.
Oh, it will be.
Law of averages.
It'll be just like Vietnam. Look what percentage of them died after it was unwinnable, the same way
and
it is now.
I say, to my opinion, bring them all home. Let the Iraqis have everything that's over there. They deserve it, the way we've treated them. We haven't given them water. We haven't given them lights that light properly. And let them, they're brilliant people. They've been around centuries longer than we have. And I think that they can handle the whole thing. I mean, they're just getting more and more frustrated, just like we are over here, only more so.
They'll figure it out.
Don't you know how frustrated they must be? When are these people going to leave our country? I really believe that they can take that, what we got, that big building and all that kind of stuff they're building over there, the embassy, mm-hmm, station and all. Let them have everything.
Yeah.
People say, oh, we got to bring that back. We got to bring that back before our boys can all come home. No, let them have it. Our boys and girls' lives are more important than all of that property that we have over there.
It certainly is. And now
can I say one more thing about the Iran thing? They're talking about blowing them, you know, mm-hmm, blowing them up with nuclear weapons. Don't they know that these nuclear weapons are more powerful than they were in the 40s when they first came out? Don't they know it's going to affect the whole world?
Well, it will, and it'll set off a chain reaction.
And they don't got sense enough. They should not be. They should be impeached today, please.
Well, that would certainly be my choice, but I think we all know it's just simply not going to happen.
And why? The same thing. It's going to affect everybody.
Well, because the Democrats want to use it for political leverage. First and foremost,
yeah,
they're
so
thinking of their
stupid
political skins, and that's what's most important, obviously, to the Democrats and Republicans, their political hides. Hey, thanks for calling, Juanita.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
I am just thoroughly burned up over that. I really am. I've been a Democrat all my life. And I was so happy last fall. I didn't go into it with rose-colored glasses. Now, don't get me wrong. I didn't think there was going to be the land of milk and honey the day after the election when the Democrats took over the House. I had hoped we'd take control of the Senate. We have a slight majority, but not enough to mean anything. But I had hopes that the Democrats would follow the will of the people that voted them into office. I had hopes that they would change things, that they would make significant progress on ending this war. I really had hopes. I wasn't 100% convinced, but there was a lot of talk and a lot of rhetoric. And stupid me, it was an election season. I should have known. But somebody please tell me, what progress have we made? And when I say we, I mean we on the left, we as the Democrats, progressive, whatever you call yourself that's not on the right. What progress have we made toward ending this war? None. None. Absolutely none. And I took my civic studies. I've studied the government. You've studied the government. I think most everybody listening to this program has an inordinate amount of knowledge about the U.S. government that a lot of people in this country don't take the time to have. And if I'm wrong, you call me and tell me I'm wrong. But I know I'm not. Nancy Pelosi could end this war. Nancy Pelosi could refuse to bring a bill, new funding bill, to the House floor. That's it. Now, while I will admit that that would be plenty controversial, I do believe that the majority of the people in the United States, if the Democrats went out and laid out their case to the public, like they could do, and said, don't buy the Bush bullshit that, oh, we're going to strand our troops over there and we're going to leave them there without their weapons and ammunition and they'll get killed. No, 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 no. There's plenty of money in the pipeline to bring them home safely right now. So if the Democrats did their jobs as our elected officials, as our representatives, people sent there to represent us and our thoughts, Nancy Pelosi could end this war. Now, if I'm wrong and you can find any place I'm wrong on that, you let me know. But I know I'm not. If she would refuse to send a bill up, a new funding bill, Bush would be screwed. Now, yes, we all know how they would try and spin it. We know that for a fact. They would try and spin it like that the Democrats are cut and run, that they're traitors, they're treasonous, and they would strand our troops and they're anti-military. You've heard the whole story. You've heard everything that they would call us. Sticks and stones that break my bones and all that crap. You've heard it. Let them. Why not just let them do it? I cannot for the life of me understand that. Do you? I just don't get it. I don't think I ever will. Why not just say, hey, go ahead and accuse us of anything you want to. We're not giving you another dime for this war. Not another dime. Why can't we do that? I don't get it. Did you ever have computer trouble right in the middle of a show? I'm having one of those ones where one of ours here in the studio is kind of locking up a little bit here right now, but hopefully we'll get it settled here in just a moment. I just don't understand, you know, and as we talked to yesterday, I think we talked to Robert Borisage about it the other day. And, you know, people, he's savvy political, but it's not being talked about in Washington about it, is pulling the funding on this. Just not being talked about. And I just am beside myself trying to figure out why. Why doesn't anybody just say, hey, Nancy Pelosi, end this war, end it now, and have the guts to do it. Stand there. Everybody's go out and stand on the front steps of the Capitol building, for God's sake, and say, no, no more. We're not giving you another damn dime for your war, Junior. Not another dime. We don't want another American killed. There's nothing he can do about it. He can manufacture the money. He cannot force the Congress into giving him the money. There is nothing he can do. Only if the Democrats would come up with enough spine to make that happen. Why don't they? Oh, I don't think I'll ever understand. Well, we're going to pause for news at the top of the hour. Don't go away. We'll be back right after the news. Going to have our guest, Rick Rowley, with us to talk about his recent trip to Iraq and the truth of what's going on over there. Once again, that's what you get on this program. You're listening to the Guy James Show and the Head on Radio Network. We'll be back right after the news.
This is the Quality News Network. President Bush is scheduled to tell the nation tonight the U.S. will withdraw 30,000 in Iraq by next summer if conditions allow. Congressional Democratic leaders are rejecting the proposal, saying it does not go far enough, fast enough. The president will address the nation from the Oval Office at 9 o'clock Eastern. The coast of Texas was lashed by the storm Umberto, which strengthened into a hurricane this morning, but has since been downgraded to a tropical storm. The region has already suffered one of the rainiest summers in 50 years. Umberto is on its way to Louisiana. A prominent sheik working with the U.S. to fight al-Qaeda in Iraq was killed by a bomb just 10 days after meeting with President Bush. Officials see Abdul Sattar's death as a setback for U.S. efforts, as it may discourage others from combating Al-Qaeda. In Afghanistan, at least 10 Afghani soldiers are dead after a suicide bomber blew himself up in an army mess hall. Also today, an attack on a base left 50 militants and 2 soldiers dead. More than 300 militants have been killed in the last 3 weeks. In Iraq, the U.S. began releasing prisoners today, a common method in which to commemorate Ramadan. The U.S. says it will free between 50 and 80 daily throughout the month. The U.S. is holding more than 23,000 Iraqis in American-run prisons. In Tokyo, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was rushed to a hospital today, admitted for what officials say is stress and exhaustion. After only a year in office, Abe yesterday resigned amidst scandal and political missteps. In Nebraska, a lawsuit has been filed against federal immigration authorities on behalf of union workers in 6 Swift meatpacking plants. The suit alleges INS agents roughly manhandled people in recent raids, even when they were not suspects. Fundamentalist Mormon leader Warren Jeffs will begin trial today. He is charged with first-degree rape as an accomplice for coercing a 14-year-old girl into marrying her 19-year-old cousin. If convicted, Jeffs could face life in prison. Former Virginia Governor Mark Warner has announced that he will be running for a seat in the Senate. The 52-year-old Democrat is looking to fill the seat of Senator John Warner, no relation, who is retiring after 30 years. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Hi, I'm Brian Gingrich of Monterey Mattress Company. The only way to travel is by using the very best, and the very best in a major sleep product is any mattress from Monterey Mattress Company. Literally serving all parts of the world, we have been building the finest latex foam and innerspring mattresses for well over 20 years. Using our world-famous hotels as a measuring stick, you'll more often hear the name Monterey Mattress, as we supply over 100 resort hotels in this area. Far exceeding industry standards, these mattresses are available to you at factory prices. In addition to the local recognition, Monterey Mattress Company has been shipping beds worldwide to the many visitors who have experienced a great night's sleep here. This is the ultimate endorsement enjoyed by very few businesses. Monterey Mattress Company. We simply build the best, whether for your home or world-renowned resorts. Visit us today at 1714 Contra Costa in Sand City or on the World Wide Web at MontereyMattress.com. Sleep like a panda bear.
UNICEF reports worldwide child deaths fell to 9.7 million in 2005, the first time that number has been under 10 million, and that's down from 13 million in 1990. An investigation by the Associated Press reveals that health inspectors failed to increase their monitoring of vegetables produced on California's central coast after last year's outbreak of E. coli in spinach. Google is promising a $30 million prize to anyone who can safely land a robotic rover on the moon and transmit a significant amount of video back to Earth. If a winner is identified, the flight will mark the first non-government lunar flight. Bank of America has increased the amount of money it charges non-customers to use the bank's ATMs. The $3 charge is the highest such fee in the nation. AT&T is discontinuing its telephone time-telling service this month. Automated time services, now affectionately referred to as popcorn, have been in existence since the 1930s. The dollar hit a new low today for the second day in a row. 1 euro can now buy $1.39. Light sweet crude is trading at $79.90 a barrel. Gold is trading at $718. The Dow is up 158. The NASDAQ up 16. S&P 500 up 15. There's more on our website at qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Reed Kaffner.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you've read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. Glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon. Great show today, having Ray McGovern on the first hour, and we're going to have Tina Richards coming up at the bottom of this hour. And right now, as promised, we have Rick Rowley with us, and Rick is just back from a month and a half in Iraq. He's a journalist with Big Noise Films. He's been there. He's seen it. He's done that. And he brings us some truth as to what is happening in Iraq and what has happened in Iraq. Rick, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We know that you've been – first of all, tell us, why did you go to Iraq in the first place?
Well, this is my second trip, and I was traveling with a co-producer, David Enders, who's been there six times.
We've had David on the program. He's, by the way, I think I mentioned to you in email yesterday, I'm an Ohio State grad. Be sure and give him my condolences about the University of Michigan.
my parents were University of Michigan grads, too, so I'll share that with him.
All right. Anyway, back to the problem in hand. This is your second trip to Iraq.
Yeah, well, and, I mean, it's unbelievably bad in Iraq. I mean, we know, we hear the statistics here, and they mean something. I mean, 600,000 to a million casualties, 4 to 6 million refugees who were forced to leave their homes. But there's really, it's impossible to really wrap your head around the scale of the human tragedy that's happening over there. I mean, it's a massive historical crime that our government is perpetrating in Iraq. And you know, and honestly, this is all I know how to do. I mean, I know how to go, and I know how to film things, and I know how to bring people's stories back. I wish there was a more direct and more concrete kind of political action I could take against this war, because, you know, I feel implicated, like I'm sure a lot of people out there feel implicated in what the government's doing. So, I mean, I really couldn't live with myself if I didn't try to find a way to go back and do this.
How difficult is it to get yourself over there now and go around and do what you have to do?
It is. It would have been impossible if we hadn't already had all the contacts that we've built up over the, you know, since 2003 when we sent our first people over there. We were embedded with the Americans for 1 week, but then after that we crisscrossed the country traveling, and the only way to do it was to travel with Iraqi militias. So we traveled around Baghdad with Muqtada al-Sadr's Mehdi army. We traveled to Najaf with the Badr brigades. We traveled to Basra with Fadila's militia. And that, you know, that's only possible because we had the connections beforehand and we were able to hook all that stuff up. So that's really the only way that you can cover the country now. I mean, we say we were unembedded, but really we were embedded just with all the different sides of the struggle.
How much time do you spend fearing for your personal safety?
Well, I mean, we do take risks there. I mean, that's definitely true. It's a risk to be there. But I think it's important, you know, to always point out that the kinds of personal risks that we take are nothing next to the risks that Iraqis face every single day just living. And, you know, there are thousands and thousands of reporters that have been killed in Iraq, but the vast majority of those are Iraqis. And a lot of those are actually killed by American soldiers. I mean, there's all these famous cases of the U.S. targeting Iraqi media, bombing Al Jazeera. They've got Al Jazeera cameraman in Guantanamo. I mean, we definitely take risks, and it's a risky place, and you always feel that kind of claustrophobic fear, and you're always looking over your shoulder and wondering what's going to happen, But really, I mean, the risks we take are nothing next to the risks of the Iraqis who are there.
Well, it sounds like life in Iraq is pure hell now. Is it good for anybody? Are the people with money? Are the people with social status? Is anybody living really well in Iraq right now?
Well, you know, in 2004, the last time I was there, I mean, David's been there in between, but in 2004, you could still find people who had good construction contracts or something, who were making money off of the Americans there, who would say, you know, it's a good thing that we got rid of Saddam, like, it's, you know, who would talk about it, there being positive aspects to the occupation. But outside of Kurdistan, you can't find that anymore. Mm. I mean, if things have gotten, the situation has deteriorated so far from 2004 till 2007 that it's almost unrecognizable. I mean, Baghdad is a city of armed camps that are turned against each other and are fighting against each other. I mean, the places we went. I mean, we went to, you know, the misery belts of refugee camps that surround Baghdad, where Shia, who've been ethnically cleansed from Anbar province and other parts of the country, are living, you know, in places where it's too dangerous for any foreign NGOs or anyone to provide services. So they're living in these little cinder block houses with no water and no plumbing and no doctors and no schools and no jobs. And you know, I mean, it's a humanitarian catastrophe of such massive proportions that you can't even wrap your head around. I mean, sometimes the details, the small details are what, like, you know, would hit you in a day and most, like the fact that while we were there, there was a fatwa issued preventing, you know, preventing people from eating the fish in the Tigris River because the fish were all eating corpses because they pulled 200 corpses a week out of the river for a while. I mean, it's bloated with bodies heading south towards Basra. I mean, it is indescribably bad, and it's going to get worse. One line that Iraqis told us over and over and over again was, yesterday was better than today, and today is better than tomorrow. There's really no, and at this point, the real tragedy is, I mean, there were moments when an immediate U.S. withdrawal would have meant, you know, things, there was a chance for a real kind of, for real hope of some kind. I mean, now, when the U.S. leaves, it's going to be bad, there's going to be violence for a while. If the U.S. stays, it's going to be worse. There is no good solution to this. To the war now.
I saw this ABC poll. One of the questions in it was, and the result was 70% of the people polled said it was worse now than it was before the surge. And yet we have Petraeus. Hey, one of the things I wanted to ask you about. I read somewhere where you were talking about General Petraeus and his report and how he feels about the Sunni militia allies. And you accused him of lying about all this, and you mentioned about when you were embedded with the U.S. military and saw what they did to woo the tribal militias. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so on the broad scheme of things, it's obvious, and it's been revealed by, you know, McClatchy and a whole bunch of different reputable journalist outfits that Petraeus was cherry-picking numbers and was distorting and deliberately misleading, you know, the Congress about the situation there. But when he was talking about the Sunni militias, he outright lied. He said, we're not supporting the Sunni militias. We're applauding them from the sidelines while they expel al-Qaeda from their neighborhood. So it's true that they're not putting guns into the hands of the Sunni militias, but directly, but they're giving them money. I mean, while we were embedded with the Americans, we saw the commanders hand wads of cash to the militia members who were guarding checkpoints. And the promise is that when these militias are part of the, are allied with Americans for a few months, then they become incorporated into the Iraqi police force, and they become an official part of Iraqi's police structure, are given a Kalashnikov, a badge, a paycheck, and the power to arrest. The U.S. is directly, materially aiding these people with money, and it's completely disingenuous and a downright lie to pretend like they're not.
And in some cases, it would almost follow that some of these people that they're handing wads of cash to have been people that have probably shot at and killed Americans.
Well, that's unquestionably true. I mean, all of the soldiers on the ground said, I mean, the American captain who we were walking around with said at one point, every single one of these people shot at us at one time in their lives. Every single one of them. That's unquestionably true. All of the soldiers understood that, absolutely. But that's a problem. That's a risk. That's a danger and something that people should keep in mind. But more important than that for me is that these people have, and many of them, are war criminals who are responsible for sectarian cleansing and who are using American support to arm themselves for a civil war. I mean, that the groups that we filmed with in Taji, I mean, we found in the refugee camps outside of Baghdad an entire village, like the entire Shia population of Falahat, this town close to Taji, which is a little bit outside of Baghdad. The entire village in 15 days was forced out. Their houses were bombed. People were killed on the highways, and 5,000 homes were, you know, the people relocated to this refugee camp. And they knew the people who kicked them out. They knew their families, their names, they knew their tribes, and they were exactly the same people who the Americans were working with now. Mm. So, you know, it's one thing to work with people who've shot at you before, but it's another thing to start arming, you know, one side of a civil war. I mean, it's clear also, I mean, at this point, the U.S. has been arming Shia militias as well. I mean, they, beginning way back in 2004, they incorporated the Badr Brigade into the Iraqi security forces, the Shia militia.
Well, it certainly wouldn't be the first time the American government has aided both sides in a fight. You know, we hear the propaganda, and I hope I'm not being unfair. I know I'm not being unfair saying that. We hear the propaganda all the time coming from the Bush administration about Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda. Every other word coming out of his mouth is Al-Qaeda. You've been there. Is Al-Qaeda the big problem, or is it the sectarian strife that's the big problem?
Well, first of all, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, I mean, there is a group in Iraq that calls itself Al-Qaeda now, and because the Americans have used the term so much, it's actually moved into Iraqi parlance in a way. But it's an Iraqi group that has no operational link to Osama bin Laden or that Al-Qaeda at all. Al-Qaeda in Iraq is a network of Iraqi resistance groups that are fighting the Americans. It's not, there are a few foreign fighters there, but something like, if you look at the prison population, I mean, the people who the Americans have arrested and claimed are fighting them are terrorists. None of them are foreign fighters. They're all Iraqis. It's unquestionably Al-Qaeda in Iraq is an Iraqi organization. And at this point, and before even, the real problem is not even, the real struggle in Iraq now is not really being fought against the Americans. It's the militias fighting against each other, and then the Americans being used by one militia or another as a weapon in that fight. I mean, a big part of the American surge strategy in Baghdad was about trying to fight the Mehdi army and split the Mehdi army and the ruling coalition in Baghdad, which is another Shiite faction, is incredibly threatened by the Mehdi army and would love to see the U.S. help weaken their militia.
Who's gonna run that place if we pull out? If we pull out, big if.
God, I mean, who runs that place now? I mean, there are many wars being fought inside Iraq, and there are many different governments inside the Iraqi government. There was a great piece that was done about just the Ministry of Interior building, like an 11-story building that houses all the different offices of the Ministry of Interior. Every single floor is controlled by a different militia, and the offices in it are controlled by a different militia. So the reporter talked about walking the stairs from the bottom to the top of the building means that you cross militia lines into a completely different sort of government. I mean, there's shadow, like militias operating inside the army who have their own prisons and their own structures. I mean, and when we travel around the country, I mean, we saw that, the Americans control nothing. They control these ever-receding green zones. And outside of that, it's one militia or another that runs the country. 70% of Baghdad is controlled by the Mehdi army. And the rest are up for grabs or under conflict now or controlled by, one or another Sunni militia or Shia militia. We went to Najaf and it's controlled entirely by the Badr Brigade. And there's a huge battle now in Basra between three parties who are fighting over that city because of Basra's oil. So already, no one runs the country. There's no one in charge. It's everything, it's bits and pieces that are being fought over all over the place.
It's got to be discouraging to the Iraqi people. We saw the fingers with the purple ink on and all the bragging that the Bush administration did about having free elections in Iraq for the first time and all, and yet seems like it's turned to nothing. They must have no hope for their government at all at this point.
It is really, 6 million people have tried to leave the country. I didn't meet any Iraqi who had hope for the future. Every Iraqi said it's going to be worse. Maybe in a generation things will get better.
A generation. You worked with David Enders on the Ghost of Anbar. Tell us a little bit about that project, will you?
Yeah, absolutely. So we went in, and one of the big stories that we were going to work on, because we knew that the success in Anbar, quote unquote, that story about the Anbar success was going to be one of the major stories that the U.S. used to try to justify continuing the occupation. So we investigated that story. So we tracked down the person who the U.S. claimed was the leader of that whole process, who is Abu Risha, who actually was just killed in Ramadi this morning. Well, we found him, and he wasn't in Ramadi. He was hiding in Amman. He had rented out the top floor of the Marriott Hotel and had this elaborate security system to get in there. And he claimed to us on camera that he was the leader of all Iraqi tribes. I mean, an absolutely preposterous claim. And that he'd completely secured Anbar province and, you know, 100% security in Ramadi. So we were amazed by that, because Anbar, as you know, your listeners, I'm sure, remember, is the place where the most U.S. soldiers have died in the entire country. It's the heartland of the Sunni insurgency. It's Fallujah, Ramadi, Bakuba. I mean, places that just, you know, the U.S. has, after repeated invasions and occupations, not been able to break the back of the insurgency. So he claimed it was completely under control, and the Americans as well were saying that there were no attacks there. So we had to go down and check it out. So we went and embedded with the Americans and went to Taji, where they were beginning the reconciliation process, quote unquote, with a group of Sunni tribes, and you know, we filmed the Sunni tribes, and then we traveled with them, and then, you know, we realized that there weren't any Shia in the town, and there used to be Shia in Taji, so we went and looked for them, and we found them in the refugee camp, as I was saying, on the outskirts of Baghdad. And they told us that these tribes who we'd filmed with in Taji were the ones who kicked them out of their home.
An amazing story. Amazing story, what's going on there. I don't think, try as we might, and the horrors that we see on TV and the stories we hear, I don't think we can possibly sit here in our comfortable seats in this country and have any understanding of it all, just how bad it is. It sounds like a total hell on earth, and yet we're getting rosy reports now from General Petraeus.
Well, I
don't know what's going to happen. If you were forced right now to make a bet on how Iraq is going to end up, will it be a united country? Will it be split up? Well, what would you say?
Well, we spent a lot of time in Kurdistan too. Not a lot of time. We spent a week out of our 6 weeks in Kurdistan, and they talked to the leaders of the PUK, the Kurdish, you know, Peshmerga military, who told us that Kurdistan will never be a part of Iraq again. I mean, that it took a million man army and 200,000 secret police to keep it, you know, part of Iraq, and it's just not going to go back and join again. So Kurdistan definitely is never going to be wired in the same way it was, and it is hard to imagine. I mean, forget together or apart, it's hard to imagine the civil war ending anytime soon. I mean, I think we've got decades. The best case scenario is decades of civil war that's contained inside Iraq. That's the best case. Worst case scenario is that it becomes a regional war. I mean, Saudi Arabia is already backing Sunni militias. Iran is backing some Shia militias. I mean, it is. There's so much oil sitting under the south that it is. It's definitely an incredible risk on the horizon.
Our good friends, the Saudis. All right. Yeah. Well, Rick, I'm so glad to have had you on the program today. You give us a better understanding of what is happening there. It's tiresome, frankly, to go on the network news and to listen to the reports coming from Petraeus and the Bush administration. It's very tiresome to hear the same story over and over again. It's good to get with people like you who've been there and have no reason to do anything other than to tell us the truth on what you see and what you hear. You don't have a political agenda on it, or just I've been there, I've seen it, this is what it is, and that's what we appreciate hearing, we do. And unless we have that, there's no way we'll ever have a better understanding in this country of what the actual situation is. Do you have a website?
Yeah, we do. It's bignoisefilms.org. And if you actually go onto the website, you can see the full report. We have an embedded YouTube link. You can watch The Ghost of Anbar and see the investigative piece we did.
Bignoisefilms.org. It's spelled just the way it is, folks. Rick, thanks once again for being on the program. You give us great insight into how things are there, and I appreciate you being with us very, very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Rick Rowley, ladies and gentlemen. Another report we've heard from his compadre and partner in the Big Noise Films, David Enders, a couple of times. We had David on, I think, live from Baghdad one day, and after he got back into this country. It's amazing to talk to these people, the independents that are there. And they're just there doing their job, doing their projects, as opposed to what you hear from the national news. It's a completely different story in many cases. You probably all heard about the Katie Couric thing by now. But my God, what a piece of fluff that the whole thing was. It's obvious that she got the dog and pony show big time over there. And now even the righties love Katie Couric. Isn't that something? Because she went over and promoted it the way they wanted it promoted. Well, that's a sad testament for the press here in this country, that's for sure. We're going to pause for a break. We'll be back.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Join us at Night Sounds this Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the very latest in new releases, one-hit wonders, and Erica Richards with Night Sounds Dedications. And remember, get your dedication in by emailing ericarichards@billyshearsmusic.com. Also, we'll have a listener's choice segment. So be there Saturday night, 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Hey, thanks for lending an ear.
Welcome back to the Guy James Show. Glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon. My, we've had a busy day here on the show, and Ray McGovern and Rick Rowley. And now, as promised, we have Tina Richards, a gal that most of you are fully aware of after seeing her on YouTube. So many of you have let me know that you saw this incident on YouTube. Tina, welcome to the program.
Thank you, guys. Nice to be on.
You are the director of Grassroots for America. You you aren't somebody who talks without experience here. You've got a son that was in the Marines, right?
Yes, my son did two tours in Iraq, including the initial invasion and also the siege on Fallujah. And he came back 80% disabled from this war.
80%. Let me ask you a question, and we have not discussed this, you and I. How does your attitude about all this differ now from what it was when your son left for Iraq the first time?
Well, I mean, even when President Bush gave his State of the Union address back in January of 2002, and he started talking about the axis of evil, about the only words that could come out of my mouth for hours was warmonger and a few explicatives in between. And I saw both sides of the aisle stand up and applaud this. And I think from that moment forward, my son had already joined the Marines when he was 17 in the year of 2000. And I just kept trying to analyze and get as much information as I could as to what the lead up to the war was. So, I mean, I was deadly opposed to the war before it began. I tried to talk my son out of going, but he really bought into what the Marines were telling him, his commanding officers, that this was going to, you know, if we didn't fight him over there, they were going to come over and kill his family, and that he had to protect America. And so by the second deployment, because he was only home just for a few short months, he at that point had started to talk a little bit about his experiences. And because he had been reassigned to another unit and kept longer than he was supposed to, and he was driving truck, and he said, you know, it was just turning into an occupation, and that the Iraqis really didn't want us there, and that's in the latter part of 2003. And but he felt that if he didn't go, his brothers in arms would die without his, you know, his knowledge, his expertise. He had to go to keep them alive. So he went the second time too.
Well, it's become a mission of protecting each other rather than making America safer. I think we heard Petraeus answer that the other day, whether or not America was safer as a result of this, and he did not answer it. He could not answer it truthfully. Our kids are over there fighting to save one another, and it's a damn shame the way this has turned out. You know, Tina, one of the reasons I had you on the program today, I get the sense that the mood is changing in Washington, and I say it's changing. I think it's maybe not the mood, but the actions by the local government and so forth. A week ago today, I was standing probably right where this incident took place involving you and the D.C. police, and I don't know. There's a sense there right now that there's a crackdown. There's a little more security going on here and there, and
I don't know if it's a crackdown. I think actually it's more of an intimidation.
Yes.
I mean, what they did to me last week was in front of 20 media during the middle of a press conference. It seems to me that that's a tactic that you're trying to intimidate other people from coming. Everybody, the police, the National Park Service police, the Capitol Police, they're all talking about what's happening on the 15th. They know that that this is not like any other march, that we do have a portion that is a permitted march, it is legal, but we also have, after that, we have another portion where we're going to have a massive die-in and a massive act of civil disobedience. We've got over 1,000 people that are registered and signed up. We've got attorneys in place and everything for them and legal observers. But this, to them, is their, I think their purpose was to intimidate. I think the same thing that happened with Reverend Yearwood when the Capitol Police attacked him. It's simply, which there was lots of media around them, and I'm not sure why the media that filmed all that, that was there for the Petraeus hearing, did not air their footage of what happened with Reverend Yearwood. But fortunately, we had Why Not News. that is there to document what the peace movement is doing.
I did not see any provocation from the Reverend. I did not see anything that warranted, well, of course, neither did I see anything that warranted bringing in a 2,000-pound horse and starting to brush you folks aside. I can testify that I had been in that very spot. I had seen posters all over the place, either on Wednesday or Thursday of last week, and here you were starting to put a poster up. And for those who haven't seen this, go ahead and describe what you were doing and what happened there.
Well, the answer had been levied with $30,000 in fines, that saying that that their posters weren't being applied properly. And at the same time, there's, you know, music companies and politicians and everything that have their posters plastered everywhere. But for some reason, it was just these anti-war posters that were being targeted with these fines. So Anne accused that we were not using the proper methods to put up posters, and so we called a press conference to put up the poster to show that we were doing it in legal compliance. We were using wheat paste, which is a mixture of flour and water, and simply, you know, with the press, there wasn't like a protest there. It was just five of us, two of us for the, you know, to put up the poster, and three people from Answer were there, and that was it. And then the next thing I know, we have this one police officer that I didn't even recognize as police officers at first, just somebody yelling and not making any sense. And then we have a horse come running in and trying to trample everybody after we were all already actually taken into custody. And on top of that, they had SWAT team, a whole SWAT team deployed there, tackling people and everything else, including my daughter, my 13-year-old daughter. Because, and I think this is the first time in D.C. history that somebody was arrested for putting up a lawful poster.
What are the regulations for putting up a poster? You said you did it with the wheat paste and all that, which we all know is water-soluble and all that. And did they give you any specific guidelines that they said that you broke?
No, they're saying that that we defaced public property, which there's other video out there on YouTube that shows that. It took the lieutenant afterwards all of about 30 seconds to completely remove the poster with nothing else showing. There was no damage or anything because we were doing it in legal compliance.
Well,
so they're just saying that we couldn't put up the poster at all, even though the law does allow us to put those posters up as a way to notify people in the grassroots of what's happening. And we don't have millions of dollars like Ari Fleischer to put on these really, you know, wonderful commercials and everything on television. We do have money to print up posters and to put those up to notify the grassroots of what's happening, and that's all we were trying to do is let people know.
Exactly right. You've got Ari Fleischer with, I believe, a budget of $15 million to run those ads day and night on TV. We've seen them all over the place. And I have to admit, Tina, your group with this SWAT team and all, you didn't look very menacing to me. you really didn't look like the type of group that if I were the commander of the police that I would have called out the SWAT team. That's what was shocking to me. First of all, there weren't that many of you, and secondly, you didn't look that mean to me. You really didn't. I think it just goes to
that they're trying to intimidate to keep people away. But they figure that when there's not very many of us here, and they can use overwhelming tactics, bullying tactics, to try to scare people from coming. And what I'm really hoping is that when they, because they know that when there's, you know, tens of thousands of us, they're not going to be able to do that. And they won't do that. So the idea is to scare as many people away so that there's not that many there. I mean, the Department of Interior is directly responsible for the Park Police, and the Capitol Police are all under the government arm that comes from the Bush administration, so that they can, you know, that this is their policy, you know. And I really believe that they don't want anybody there challenging Petraeus. And the fact that this march is led by Iraq Veterans Against the War, with great support from military families and from Veterans for Peace, veterans of prior wars, that and the leading Muslim groups are, you know, all in with this, that it frightens them, because it is those that have experienced the war, those that voices that are most authoritative on the war,
are directly challenging Bush and Petraeus, who has completely echoed everything that Bush has said over the last year. I don't know. Did you see John Stewart's show last night?
Yes.
And comparing Bush and Petraeus with the words just exactly the same.
Well, you know, Tina, this all points out to me that they're obviously a hell of a lot more scared about you and intimidated by you than you are intimidated by them. And I applaud your courage through all this. I really do. I know you're not someone that backs down. Obviously, you have not. You're planning on taking part Saturday?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I risk, if I am arrested during the civil disobedience, both Adam and I were told that we're looking at 3 weeks of prison time for being involved. And, you know, we're willing to risk that because the families and the vets, you know, we have been living with this war 24/7 since it began. We don't get to turn off the radio or the TV or close the newspaper and the war's over for us. I mean, this is something that we live with all the time. And maybe that's why I'm not afraid of the police or their SWAT teams or horses. Because our family has already suffered so much over the last going on the fifth year because of this war. And I know so many of my friends who have suffered so much. And for us, if we're willing to go ahead and lay our bodies down and put it on the line because we just feel this and we are hurt so deeply by this war. And now to see all this support from different peace groups and from the other vets of prior wars to lay down with us and to support us and be there with us really means a lot that they're really there for us as we keep hearing said. And it just means a lot to us to do that act together as a civil disobedience, as a funeral for all those that have fallen so needlessly, all the innocent Iraqis and all of our sons and daughters over in Iraq.
Well, I always like to ask the question, you know, there are many who don't approve of civil disobedience. I like to ask the question, how long would the Vietnam War have gone on without civil disobedience? It would have lasted for years and years and years longer if people hadn't had the courage to go out and demonstrate and protest against that war, massive protest.
I think it has to go down to civil resistance, actually. And, you know, you go back to the time of we will not be silent during World War II and everything and all the actions of the Germans, and you had a group saying, you know, fighting the resistance, the resisting, that when you know your government is doing great wrong, it is your duty as a citizen to resist your government. And that is what we are doing, is doing civil resistance. We resist what our government is doing.
What are you going to do Saturday? How's your day going to start? Where are you going to be? I mean, don't tell me which street corner. I don't want the SWAT team listening to the program and finding you right away. they could be doing that, you know. they've used more nefarious means than that before. But
I know. Whenever I post anything to my website at grassrootsamericaforus.org, within 20 minutes, I get a call from the Special Investigations Unit from the Capitol Police saying, now, what exactly does this mean when you say you're going to be at the Peace Monument or something like that?
Oh, my God.
But, no, my day is going to begin right there at the early in the morning. I plan on arriving there at Lafayette Park and being there to greet a lot of friends that I know, people that I know from the peace movement, my family now. From across the country that are coming in. And then I'll be speaking when we're going to have some speakers starting at noon at in front of the White House. And from there,
let me interrupt for just a moment. For those of you that aren't familiar with it, Lafayette Park is directly north of the White House. It's right across the street from Pennsylvania Avenue, which is now closed off to the public. There's a big statue of Lafayette in the middle and a fountain and so forth, and the rows of brownstones on both sides and on Jackson Street, and I forget F or Jackson or whatever the other one is. And so it's a beautiful park and room for lots of folks, and you're going to be in there. Okay, we just wanted to describe.
Yep, I'll be there. And then Reverend Yearwood, he's going to be having to use a wheelchair because they broke his leg when they tackled him and attacked him there in the Capitol in the halls of Congress. And I'll be up there with my friend, with my Reverend Yearwood, and with the vets and with the other military families and the other veterans you know, marching to the Capitol to tell Congress to end this war now.
Okay.
You know, we can no longer, you know, this is just not going to go on. They need to stand up to President Bush, and they need to tell him that they are not going to continue to fund this war, that this war cannot go on. And there's many ways that they can do it, including not even introducing the bill for vote. So then they don't even have to worry about the excuse of saying they can't get the vote. They have the power to do this. If they have the Democrats have the majority, they can simply not put a bill forward. It's up to them whether they put it forward or not.
I think we mentioned that earlier in the program. Correct me if I'm wrong, but this could all be in Nancy Pelosi's hands to not even bring a bill up, right?
Absolutely. That's the power. I mean, that's what the Republicans did, that were the Democrats always criticized them of, was, you know, if they chose not to put something, you know, on the floor, it wasn't put on the floor. They had their own agenda and they put it forth. That's why the American people said, you know, we don't like your agenda. You're not going to have the power anymore. And in November of 2006, we handed it over to the Democrats with the promises that they'd end the war, that they'd stop the corruption. And so once they got that power, did they use it? No.
So
they
far,
keep walking
nothing.
Around saying, we don't have the votes. It's, you know, one thing that I keep hearing over and over, and I'm on the Hill every day, I advocate for veterans' rights and veterans' benefits. And the one thing I hear over and over on the Hill is that the war, as long as it continues, it is going to be a victory for the Democrats because it reminds people, you know, of what's happening. And not only, you know, with having a Republican in, and not only that, they won't do impeachment because they love the fact that George Bush is in there, that more and more people get angrier and angrier as more and more scandal gets uncovered. And they don't want to have somebody more neutral put in, because then how are they going to be able to increase their majority next year in 08? And to me, that's a disservice to the people. It's a disservice to the Constitution that they've sworn oath to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the weakest. When I hear that, I just am enraged when I hear that. Well, why don't they just come out and say, well, we're just going to use it for political gain. Just say it. Tell it like it is, because that's what that attitude projects. Tina, your website? Grassroots?
GrassrootsAmericaForUs.org.
And that's a number four, right?
Yes, and that's the number four. And also on September 18th, I'm calling for a Congressional Occupation Day. I hope that nationally, if you can't be in D.C., to occupy your offices of your local congressperson and senators. Right now, the Free Republic, the Move America Forward, the Minutemen, basically the people that really, you know, promote war and promote bigotry and hatred are going to be lobbying your representative in Washington, D.C. on that day. And I really hope that everybody will go to their congressperson's office, either locally or here in D.C., and stand with us as we say no more to the haters of our nation, that we unite as people of peace.
The Freebers are going to be there on the 18th?
Yep, the Free Republic, every bigoted hate group that you could imagine.
Ooh.
Is going to be there lobbying your representative that day to promote George Bush's policy.
I ran into brave group of those Freebers down in Crawford, Texas one time doing the show.
So did I.
a more motley crew I have never seen, must admit.
Yeah.
Oh, out there by the football stadium, they were protesting when we were having a big rally out there one day. We went down and did the show from Crawford, and Cindy and the group are headed out to that little football stadium and having a big rally, and the Freebers were out there, and I couldn't wait to see the Freebers, and I finally saw this group and I thought, oh my God. It was I was
well, they're getting a lot more funding from somewhere now, and you know, it is something that, you know, we do need to make sure that our voices challenge their voices.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
To know that they are truly the minority.
Never a shortage of funding on that side.
Yeah, it never is. So that's why, you know, it's important to go to your congressional offices and let them know that they are the minority.
Doesn't.
So we have to show up in numbers to really prove it. I mean, I had Garrett Reppenhagen, the chairman of Iraq Vets Against the War, had a meeting with Kerry. And Kerry said, you know, I've had 500 people in front of me this week, and you're the first person to talk about peace.
Hmm.
And the point is that we have the lobbyists there. We have the people that are profiteering off this war there. we have all these corporate lobbyists there that are advocating war, that are advocating how to promote their agenda with fattening their pocketbooks with no regard to the citizens or the people that live here. And we have to be in there challenging them. We have to take back our government and take back our democracy. And the only way we can really do that is if we fully participate in it.
Well, we have to do it. We don't have a choice. We're not going to have a republic left anymore, a democracy, if we don't. It's just that simple. Tina, thank you for all you do, and thank you for being on the program, and continued success, and we'll be watching you. Maybe not like the D.C. police is watching you, but and the Capitol Police, but we hope to get back to you again soon and maybe find out the invite you to give me a call, by the way, and let me know how things go. And okay, we'd love to have you on the program once again, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Guy. I really enjoyed it.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tina Richards from Grassroots America 4. That's a number 4, us.org. Thank you, Tina. Bye-bye. Always a pleasure to have the folks on or out doing the, as we like to say, the grunt work for the rest of us that can't necessarily get to some of these protests and demonstrations and so forth. And Tina is one. She's the one that the big horsey came running after in the SWAT team. I saw that and I thought, oh my God. Hey, we'll be back in just a couple moments. I think this is an appropriate piece of music right now. La 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 la.
Dear Mr. President, come take a walk with me.
Take a walk with me.
Let's pretend we're just two people and you're not better than me. I'd like to ask you some questions if we can speak honestly. What do you feel when you see all the homeless on the street? Who do you pray for at night before you go to sleep? What do you feel when you look in the mirror? Are you proud? How do you sleep while the rest of us cry? How do you dream when a mother has no chance to say goodbye? How do you walk with your head held high? Can you even look me in the eye and tell me why? Dear Mr. President, were you a lonely boy? Can you say no child is left behind? We're not dumb and we're not blind. They're all sitting in your cells while you pave the road to hell. What kind of father would take his own daughter's rights away? And what kind of father might hate his own daughter if she were gay?
Mr. President, you'd never take a walk with me. Would you?
Dear Mr. President, well, I wouldn't address him in endearing terms like that, because I don't feel that way towards him. How can I feel? How else can I feel about a man who's been virtually a despot since he came into office? How else can I feel about a man who stole the office first time around, won the second one by the slimmest of margins, if that, and I have my doubts about that, and acted as though he had a mandate to rule this country like a king? How else could I feel about somebody like that? How else could I feel about somebody that's taken this country into a needless war and lost almost 4,000 American lives and killed hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis? And my God, look what they've done to the refugees from that country. The people of that country. Broken the treasury of this country. The national psyche is at an all-time low. Certainly for our generation it is. Yeah, watch him tonight. Watch him spread his propaganda tonight that's been written for him on how to sway the American public into coming over on his side on this. Watch him tonight. And do remember, as you're watching, that's exactly what you'll be seeing, is pure, unadulterated propaganda to try and save his legacy and keep his war going until he can get out of office and rid himself of it and blame it on whoever follows him into that office. Keep that in mind. Do keep in mind, and I just received this locally here, Congressman Connie Mack, Republican here. There's an anti-war protest Saturday the 15th in front of Connie Mack's place at 804 Nichols Parkway in Cape Coral. For information, call 369-3129. 369-3129. Thank you, John. I appreciate that. Appreciate that. Bring signs. Impeach Cheney and Bush. Visit your congressman's office. You are obliged to do so. You are the citizens of this country. We all owe it to one another to make sure that these people know our feelings about this. And if they don't act, just keep letting them know over and over and over again until they finally, ultimately have to act on our behalf instead of their own, saving their own political asses. Thanks for listening today. Been a pleasure having you. Appreciate the guests being on today. Thank you, Ray, Rick, and Tina. Listen to the Guy James Show and the Head On Radio Network, and don't you forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. See you next week, gang.